Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Chronic Effects. So happy to have you sitting in with us again. It's been an interesting time. Interesting time always is. I looked out at where I am, high up on the surface of the earth. We experience different seasons. And I'm struck. In the northern hemisphere, we're moving toward winter. And in the south, to our mates in Australia and New Zealand, they're moving into summer. And enjoy it. I hope it is. Can't say that you will be able to escape the effects of what's happening with our global climate. But let's hope that you manage it as well as can be expected. I don't think there's any other way of saying that, as awkward as that sounds. I'm just reminded that there's an estimate. You know, these are numbers that are hard for anybody to relate because they don't make any sense, really. A billion trillion stars in the universe. A billion trillion stars. And here we are revolving on a little planet, circling around one of them. And it's big, and it's powerful, and it has a gravity. And for the longest time, I thought, well, these are just hanging in this ether. They're just hanging there. But, you know, we're moving. Yeah, Hermes Trismegistus was, you know, when the Hermetics were, you know, are suggesting everything is in motion all the time. We're catapulting through this darkness, through this time space, and all these little things. Our star is moving constantly, and all these things, the gravity and all the forces, are so powerful. It's drawing us along. So instead of like little circles around a static star, it's like these spirals. You know, you ever see those pictures of somebody trying to portray a wormhole? And it's like this spiral. And that's, we're in one of those spirals. We're on that. And following our star. And it's being influenced by bodies and by mass far greater than itself. That we haven't, some of it we've identified and some not, but we will. I suspect we'll come up with a theory to try and explain it best we can, being an attempt to be factual. It is a miracle. And I guess here I am. I'm not a formal religion left me a long, long time ago. But the idea of miracle, no. I worked recently with a very, very wonderful person who talked to me about her belief in angels, and I certainly understand that. So as a concept, to understand the concept of a miracle, well, I can attempt to understand the mathematics of what's happening around, but I prefer, you know, if you gave me a formula to explain something, I would much prefer your philosopher colleague to help me to give me a narrative. And it's only because of my What? It's only because that I've not taken the time to study. I was going to say because I've my limits, but I can't do that anymore. You reach a point where you understand that it's just a matter of dedicating your time and attention and having being inspired in some way. Yeah. And doing the legwork, isn't it? It is a miracle. And to think that, you know, we're finding these fragments of larger bodies that have exploded a long, long time ago into fragments. And inside those fragments, we discover traces of the elements of life, a drop of water, amino acids. And then we begin to think about it. It begins to think, well, you know, here we have this one little blue planet in the universe, and we know that because we took a picture of it when we were traveling, you know, put up some vehicles into space. And it's surrounded by this very, very thin, relative to the universe around us, very thin atmosphere, isn't it? And we depend on that and on those balances. The atmosphere shields us from a lot of radiation, and it also helps to contain the right balance of moisture and heat that we thrive on and have done for a very long, well, compared to dinosaurs. We haven't been around as long as the dinosaurs, but we've been around for a while. And to think that's not that's miracle enough, but to think that here we wonder, it almost sounds like the resolution, a biblical resolution of man being lonely and some benevolent creature creating or entity creating woman as companionship. We seem to need or seek the companion. Is there somebody else like us? Is there other sensate conscious being out there in the universe, or are we truly all alone? Well, so far... so far, we can dream it, we can wish it, but we are alone, and we're unique in that way. Oh, we could become immediately self-absorbed and think of all the things that are apparently wrong, you know, be all judgmental. That's a product of our consciousness, isn't it? Our self-awareness. That it's an interesting phenomenon. It's like illusions that we create, that I think we create for ourselves. And here, if you all sitting down and you have whatever, you're sipping whatever it is that you love to sip when you listen to the show. Help me with this. We have the illusion of time and space. Time, space, we refer to it. When I was a little boy, we didn't have time, space. We had time and we had space. And then you scratched your head. And the people around me, my instructors, my teachers, had no clue what that was about, the darlings. But when you start to try to comprehend, I have to admit, when you challenge me, you sit me down and say, explain the past and explain the future. I know it, but I can't explain it. It's like the time I used to wear a wristwatch before all this, before iPhones, smartphones were so handy. I still wear my wristwatch, but if you ask me, you ask me what time it is, I can tell you, but you ask me what that is, I have no idea. Oh, it's numbers here. You see all these little, and remember the controversy when digital clocks came out? You know, how is this, you know, we have this configuration that it teaches a sort of some relative sense of time to children. The face with all the numbers around it, you know, 12 numbers around it. And when it's just a digit, how are our children going to conceptualize that? Well, somehow we did. Always we're fooling around, always we're messing with the idea of time. And yet I began to wonder as I was preparing the program for you this week, the illusions and how much else is illusion that, and Does it matter? Does it matter if we're aware of it or not? Well, some would say, you know, I'm far too busy and, you know, that's not a priority for me. I guess to those folks, I wonder, in an ideal world, would everybody be self-aware all the time to everything? I would not. That might be what Thomas More had in mind, where Aquinas was scratching the surface. But I don't know if I think that's what we have. I think that's what we are. We're self-aware. But when you ask us, you find that we have some of us have no real interest. We have this thing called interest and focus. Oh my goodness, who's in charge of that, eh? The state? Well, apparently not. Media? Well, apparently not. Faith or organized religion? Well, apparently not. The individual does. The individual. So travel with me today. Take a walk with me. You know, we're going to stroll. We travelers, we're moving through time. Everything's moving around us. Interesting. And we could struggle, oh my goodness, you know, what's going to happen next? You know, it's doom and gloom. Or we could, I know, it's one of those things about masonry, you know, tace, aude vide, tace. What if we watch? What if we experience it and just let our thoughts flow along. Think that we're being catapulted through, what are we spinning at on the surface? 35,000 kilometers an hour, is that roughly the spin of, you know, we're spinning. We're a product of gravity, creates all that beautiful wind and tides and stuff like that, sure. In all of that motion, we have consciousness. And in all of that consciousness, we have agency. And I believe that. But if you ask, you know, if the ideal, wherever the ideal is that everybody's self-aware all the time of everything, isn't that what we are? Only when you do that, you find that some people have very, very little interest. They're completely focused on the responsibilities of daily living, getting on with life. And who am I? Who am I to judge that that's wrong? I can't explain most of what we're talking about. I can't explain dark matter. I can't explain dark holes. I can't explain time. I can't explain time space. There's lots. I can't explain how we happen to be here. Although we try. We can look at the science of it all, but you know, we're still scratching the surface of the motive. Was there a motive? In other words, did we have a divine intervention that purposefully was the purpose? Well, probably not, I think. But all of that aside, that's like saying, did your parents truly, were they truly infatuated? Were they in love? Was theirs the relationship of the century in order to validate your existence? Well, it doesn't really matter. It's more like, what did you do with it? What did you do with the opportunity? And as we mature, we might reach a point where, oh my goodness, I'm wasting myself away. I'm wasting this opportunity. I need to buckle down. You're feeling the responsibility for yourself, for your situation. It's a lovely, lovely engagement, I think. But in that same conversation, we'll find people that could be easily overwhelmed by it, that those tipping points, you know, where we're at. Let me put it this way. Years and years ago, I was a little baby therapist. And you're trying to put perspective. And my mentors, it's very, very brilliant mentors. Not perfect, but brilliant. Who have no idea anymore what perfect would be. Brilliant. And one, I still remember the conversation and where we were, said, you know, you'll be looking at around 6,000 hours, about 6,000 patients 6,000 patients to before you begin to understand our craft, 6,000 patients. So, and I was encouraged to only work with the most difficult cases. Always the most difficult. If you were inclined to learn, the most difficult being the source of the greatest learning, the more complex because of the complexity that had to be sorted out. And son of a gun, you're now past retirement. Yeah, that was quite accurate. Somebody had passed that on to them, and they passed that on to me. It's quite true. And I remember, you know, you do the rough calculation how many people you see in a day, in a week, in a month, in a year. And it's fairly easy to start to calculate. It's an approximation. It's not like, oh, you know, it's not that precise. But as I was getting up to around 6,000 patients, son of a gun, I was asking myself the question again. I had a sense of what was going on, and I had a sense that there was so much more to learn. There were so many variations on the theme, like 7.5 billion of variations on the theme, but that you begin to have a sense of comfort that there's things that are familiar, and things that human beings share one to the other. I won't get into that anymore, but to think that I asked myself, was I unaware at 5,000, I'll ask you, at 5,999, was I completely unaware? And then at 6,000, was I completely aware? Or are we really talking about familiarity? How do you familiarize yourself with these things? And again, is it possible to be familiar with everything all the time? Well, no. The beauty is the engagement. I have you and your friends and your neighbors and the people around you. And I have my tribe and my people, and they have their own interests. Each of them is an individual project in progress, always a work in progress. But the idea here is that I'm getting at is that we're continually exchanging ideas. We have this constant dialogue, and it doesn't mean we have to. You know, I understand there's some artifacts, some things that happen to personalities and thinking because of the effects of the kind of lifestyle, the communities, and the way we have chosen to exist, the so-called pressures and things like that are real pressures. But the idea of the exchange of idea, of thought, means that I can be constantly educated. I can constantly learn, not as competition. Now, I know competition, predatory capitalism teaches us that. You know, everything's a competition. You got to be better and first. Well, no. It's just a simplistic it's a metaphor. So if you see the exchange for what it is, somebody else has a different idea, we can learn from that. If we have the interest, and if we have pay a bit of attention, it's like you think about it. This is a struggle, because a lot of people, when they're in those situations, will tend to be explaining, using anecdotes to explain the point. Well, the difference, you know, it's like a stereotype. You give an anecdote. The difficulty with anecdote is that it's rarely complete. It's sort of like, well, what I remember of something that happened 10 years ago, I'll try and recount for you. And we know what memory does, don't we? I have a spot on memory of everything that ever happened to me. Yeah, wishful. So we filter it through. The anecdote is always incomplete, always. So the explanation is always incomplete, always incomplete. It doesn't stop us doing it. But we can filter all of that out. That's this, you know, the wonderful nature of our minds. We can filter all of that out, put it in context. And it never stops. And thank goodness, I'm one of the fortunate who stumbled into this whole process, this whole fraternity. Called Freemasonry. Just it took what I thought was an active mind and just began to beautifully expand it, so that my interests began to have a different context. It was and the more I started off like you, scratching the surface and wondering. And the more I did that, the more I dug in and the more I remembered. And it wasn't like on purpose. It was like, oh, how do I know that about Plato and the relationship of the ideas of Aristotle? How do I know that and why? And then we're all moving through this ether. And I have opinion about things like that now. I have opinion about things. I wouldn't, I would think it would be just a complete randomness. I might have reached this point by stumbling along on my own. I might have, you know, give a monkey a typewriter and lock him in a room and he'll eventually produce Shakespeare. Nah. I feel a deep sense of gratitude. Oh, I'm terrible. Yeah, I'm not as good a person as you are, or as devout as those guys are. I don't respect authority for the sake of authority. I'm a rationalist. If it makes sense at the time, if you're not loudish about it, then yeah, it makes sense to me. I tend to relate authority and obedience to purpose. Somebody telling me that's the way it is because no. What's, you know, if there's some benefit, if I can see the greater good, I'm just fascinated by that kind of thinking. And I believe that kind of thinking, that there is a sense of the greater good. And I know that there are people that are clamoring to bend the rules and break the rules to get an advantage, to make the profit, to be successful. I know that. But if in levels of importance and levels of integrity, authenticity, those things don't really exist. It's like the past and the future only exist in my mind. In the mind. I live in the moment, just like you. We filter through and our history. We filter it through. Do I trust it? Well, it's interesting that you would ask about trust in history. Can I confirm it? You know, then I can begin to, at first, lovely stories. I don't have a problem with that. I like the story. Tell me the story of George III, the king. Tell me that story. I like the story. And then I can, now we're fortunate, we have scholars that are pulling the threads apart and finding out more of the truth, more accurately what was going on at the time. And you know, do I know about Helen of Troy? Well, yeah, is she a concept? Did she actually really exist? And when Homer was writing, you know, did those Argonauts really, you know? So that's the kind of fascination. I sit here with you today, I'm just astounded. Just astounded that, and I wouldn't walk around trying to impart this kind of, they have this conversation with very many people. My goodness, can you imagine? They think I was a bit daft. The remarkable, a miracle that we are here on so many different levels. a miracle that we can have the we can communicate our ideas. A miracle that we can employ our efforts, organize our efforts at self-development, at improvement. That I'm not so important. There's always room for improvement. Yeah, and to do that, I could say, well, my goodness, that must be very, very difficult, wouldn't you think? I could also say, Freemasonry does it, makes it look easy. Like a real, I keep thinking of the true Freemason. You do it with, you live a life with a state of grace. a state of dignity, respect for your, for the condition of the fellows around you. Dignity, purpose, all of it in living and just bringing that moment to get, bringing that moment. This is the kind of program we have today. the commentary, lived life. Oh, please. But I found a poet that should have had on the program a long, long time ago. One of these brilliant family of three writers. I know. I'll just leave you, tease you. Well, tease you just a little bit. This brilliant, brilliant piece of work. And some of you may know, No Coward Soul Is Mine. And we'll get into that. Just a really satisfying bit of poetry. But let's get on with the program. And sit back and enjoy some of this, you know, stunning music. This is Stan Getz from Stan Getz at Large. Isn't it? Yeah. Thank you. Just beautiful. Gorgeous music. Here, help me with this. This is a commentary. Lived life. Yeah. I was thinking about the commonality between us when I wrote this. And that being Masonic lifestyle, Masonic energy, the idea, the philosophy. To understand Freemasonry requires lived life. Let me explain that. It has bits that require a slow, deep read because metaphor is often layered. There are pieces that you want to have on your bed table for years, so it's available to infect your thinking. It's not surprising readers struggle with meaning. I think anyone trying to gain a Masonic education will already have some familiarity with the classics, the genius of Shakespeare and Cervantes and Proust, Melville, Dante. He will know about the rawness of life through Tolstoy's War and Peace, one of the greatest novels ever written. It sits on my shelf because it contains so much description of thought and his delicate explorations of Freemasonry. Agreed, it is easier to appreciate some, but remember Ulysses was offered up by James Joyce defiantly to readers as a 17-year read. It is hard. Every chapter an experiment in literary convention. Freemasonry is indispensable to a man who values the private mysteries we absorb from written language. Add philosophy, history, metaphysics to grasping meaning. Masonry isn't restrained by borders or language, and neither should you. There are rich rewards following Scottish, French, Czech, or German journeys into critical thinking. This takes nothing away from English Masonry. And remember, there is always more to read that will change the thinking of open-minded types. Imagine a life in which imagination and fact flows into the virtuous life of a Freemason. Keep asking yourself why. Why are certain things boring? Why do some works excite and resonate? Read and talk about your work as often as you can, using the lexicon. Continue to indulge. Commit to meta-learning, learning how to learn. Learn the art. Go and visit Masonic Effects regularly. Preoccupation, eh? We make sense of it when you've lived life, and I like the company of people that have a few bruises and knocks and scars of life that life has served up to them, that have a sense of calamity and and just how fragile and delicate this thing we call a life really is. So I like that. People that don't have all the answers. The rest I find, you know, those people I find tedious. You know, they're so self-conscious. Anyway, here's some a beautiful piece of work. This is from Rudy Van Gelder's edition of Idle Moments. Just fun. Van Gelder, yeah, beautiful, beautiful music. I want to tuck in, I'm going to share the work of a poet, of a family of poets, from a family of poets. Now, I know I'll be a bit more tedious with this. I say tedious, so I should be a little bit more detailed. with a bit of the background, because it revealed something really quite jaw-dropping. If you at all have studied the classics, you'll recognize the point here. This is about a poem written by Emily Bronte. Emily Jane Bronte. She was born in 1818. So this would have been the work that a lot of the designers of masonry, you know, in the 19th century, the designers would have been picking up or had adding to their library. And she lived and died. She died in 1848 in Harworth, Yorkshire. But get this. She was the daughter of Patrick Bronte, who was an Irishman and a clergy. And in 1820, their father became a rector of Haworth. And he stayed there the rest of his life, did well, you know, provided for the family. But the mother died in 1821, and the children were very much left to themselves in what they describe as a bleak moorland rectory. Okay, so you can picture that, you know, isolated. My goodness. The children were educated during their early life at home, as they were fortunate. They had access to somebody that was able to teach. And except for a single year, Charlotte and Emily spent at the clergy daughter's school at Cowanbridge, they were self-taught or homeschooled. In 1835, she was still very, very young, Charlotte secured the older sister secured a teaching position at Miss Woolner's school at Roe Head, and Emily accompanied her as a pupil, but she was very, very homesick and left, and she only stayed there 3 months. But in 1838, 3 years later, Emily spent 6 months as a teacher in Miss Paget's school near Halifax, and then she resigned. She'd had enough of that. It was just wearing her out. So this was a temperamental young woman. And to keep the family together, Charlotte planned to keep a school for girls at Haworth. And in February 1842, she and Emily went to Brussels to learn foreign languages and school management at the Pension Hegge. You bet. Well, we'll just go there and we'll learn foreign languages. These are astounding. Although Emily pined for a home and the moorlands, it seems that Brussels was better. She was better appreciated than her sister Charlotte. We talk about Charlotte's decorous temperament and her passionate, but Emily had the passionate nature. And in October, when her aunt died, Emily returned permanently to Haworth. So here, the story gets a little more interesting here. 1845, Charlotte came across some poems by Emily. And this led to the discovery that all three sisters, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, had written verse. Private. A year later, they published jointly a volume of their verse. Wouldn't I love to have a copy of the poems of Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell, and the initials of those pseudonyms being of the sisters. And it contained 21 of Emily's poems, and a consensus of later criticism has accepted the fact that Emily's verse alone reveals true poetic genius. The venture cost the sisters about £50 in all, and only two copies were sold. In mid-summer 1847, Emily's Wuthering Heights and Anne's Agnes Grey had been accepted for joint publication at Newby's in London, but publication of the three volumes was delayed until the appearance of their sister Charlotte's Jane Eyre. Could you listen to what we're talking about? Wuthering Heights, Agnes Grey, and then the Jane Eyre, which was immediately and hugely success. No kidding, it was a success. Wuthering Heights was published in December 1847, and it didn't do well. Critics were hostile. If you've read it, critics were hostile, and they called it too savage, too animal-like and clumsy. And this is only what we consider one of the finest novels in English language. So message here, note to self, if you're producing something and people sneer at it a little bit, just be a lesson. They eviscerated Wuthering Heights, you know, and can you imagine the talent of the people that were, there are the talentless critics that did that, eh? But soon after the publication of her novel, Emily's health began to fail rapidly, and she was ill for some time. And she had breathing problems, and she was in pain, and she died of tuberculosis in December 1848. Now, Emily's work on Wuthering Heights cannot be dated. She may well have spent a long time on this intense, solidly imagined novel. It is distinguished from other novels of the period by its dramatic and presentation, its abstention from all comment by the author, and its unusual structure. It recounts in the retrospective narrative of an onlooker, which in turn includes shorter narratives, the impact of the waif Heathcliff on the two families at Avernshaw and Linton. But that's not why we're here. That's not what we're here about. And more, if you want to know more about this unusual, this brilliant family, the pseudonym, look for the pseudonym Acton Bell, because, you know, decent women didn't write, and who would read a woman's work? That was Anne Bronte. I'll leave that. We're going to tuck into one of Emily's more striking poems. This is No Coward Soul Is Mine. And this was published a couple of years before she died in 1846. This poem examines the power of faith and the nature of the divine. And it opens with the speaker declaring that despite all the challenges and troubles in the world, her faith makes her brave. The speaker doesn't doubt her faith, but she knows that God lives within her, lending her strength and fortitude. God resides in every living creature, the speaker says, imbuing them with a divine immortality. Well, I'm the deist, you know, I'm more the force, you know. I look out and see pantheist, maybe. I see God, this force in everything. Here, I won't get into more. There's so much more. So much more of this. It's just, no coward soul is mine. No trembler in the world's storm-troubled sphere. I see heaven's glories shine, and faith shines equal, arming me for fear. O God, within my breast, almighty, ever-present deity, life that in me has rest, as I, undying life, have power in thee. Vain are the thousand creeds that move men's hearts. Unutterably vain. Worthless as withered weeds, or idless froth in the boundless main. To awaken doubt in one holding so fast by thine infinity, so surely anchored on the steadfast rock of immortality, while wide embracing love, thy spirit animates eternal years, pervades and broods above, changes, sustains, dissolves, creates, and rears. Though earth and moon were gone, and suns and universes ceased to be, and thou wert left alone, every existence would exist in thee. There is not room for death, nor atom that this might could render void. Thou art being and breath, and what thou art may never be destroyed. Faith, eh? We may want to, you know, weigh and measure, you know, what she's saying about nature and God and our all of that type of thing. What that say to you will be different than what she's saying to me. That's beautiful. That is. So is John Coltrane. Thank you. really is just lovely. We're shifting now at shifting the history. The focus of the history that we're talking about here is a little bit different. We're switching. We're moving from Amsterdam, and, you know, into Stockholm, up into Sweden. Influence. Remember, we back this up. We're looking at the influence of British masonry, and it's spread. You could say that's curiosity, that it's engagement. There's lots of reasons that the ritual was spreading. We won't really get into that now. I'll leave that to your imagination. This account suggests that in Sweden, the profane suspected the Freemasons of political intrigue, licentiousness, and perhaps most cynically, of siring illegitimate children to be provided for by charity. Now, before we get boyish and silly about this, think about this. This is the way, these are the comments that were going on. They were siring illegitimate children and then providing the charity to take care of them. But the habit didn't save the order from hostility. Charity had been central to a Swedish Freemasonry since its inception in the 1730s. Hostile speculations directed against the Freemasons also meant speculations against some of the most important elements of Swedish society and government. Despite this context, were the rivalry between the two main political parties in Sweden also reflected social and cultural differences. The charges against the lodges were nevertheless similar to the kinds of accusations against the fraternity that occurred in almost every European country, time and time again. So we were being layered into that. Sexual license appears almost invariably. That sort of innuendo is also reminiscent of the charges frequently leveled against the traditional clergy and sometimes against the aristocracy. Masonic secrecy may have conjured up the same set of profound social and class resentments. Although entertained beyond anything some of them had experienced, the gentlemen of the very elite Swedish lodges were not so intimidated by the possibility of innuendo that they refrained from rudely disdaining the wife of an ambassador or daring to appear in public in full regalia. The three lodges had over 300 members. The officers were government officials, chancellors, the secretary to the king, his physician, a surgeon, the secretary of state as grand master, officers of the army, the secretary of the royal archives, an iron merchant, magistrates of the city. On the occasion of this meeting in Stockholm, the usual sense of the solemnity and importance of the proceedings was reinforced by the grandeur of the court. Between it and the speculations of the profane lay a gulf that defies easy explanation. It is not sufficient to say that the chasm between the Swedish lodges and the larger society was simply a reflection of the arrogance permitted noblemen and magistrates. There's every reason to believe the humbler brothers, in far less elevated or secure circumstance, would have behaved exactly the same way. We're getting off on it. We're getting off on it. So the presence, what all this is saying is that it mattered, And where I am, we concern ourselves not only with the bigger picture of the relevance, but with the local sense. It doesn't really matter. Put up your symbols. Who cares? I think more than weighing out the validity of what we're doing, I think this is a matter of the sophistication, the level of sophistication that's out there in the profane world. What do you think? We put the cap back in the bottle, the cork back in. We come to an end of sorts again. I hope this has been entertaining. You know, what can I say? And thank you for tuning in, wherever you might be around the world. It's a pleasure to have you sit in for whatever. I began to wonder how and why people in different places are tuning into the show, and it doesn't matter. What's important is that you've been coming back for a long time, some of you for 10 years. And that is very, very validating, I guess you could say, you know, and much appreciated. And I hope that you join me again in a few days, and we'll pick this up where we left off. It doesn't seem to end, does it? Thanks, and commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and particularly be gentle with yourself. See you soon.